All right, well, thank you. The first lecture after lunch on the hardest day of the week doesn't give me a whole lot of hope, but we'll give it a shot. I actually had a thought that I was going to share, and it flew my mind. It's Thursday. I will say I've got a lot of pins on my badge. I've been trying to give them out. But I'll also say I prepared for this week because up until Friday of last week, I had about shoulder-length hair, full flowing locks. And I said, that's not going to be good for pinning, so I cut it in preparation. But it doesn't seem to be doing a whole lot of good. And I would also say that for those of you who might mock, just remember what happened to the boys that were mocking Elisha. Go up, you bald head, okay? Just remember that, because God made only a few perfect heads, and the rest of them he covered with hair, all right? I also tell my youngest brother, who has a great head of hair, he also has really nice biceps. But you can have hair or you can have brains, but you can't have both, and he's proof of that. All right, so yesterday we talked a little bit about personal finances, and there's a lot more that could be said. And what we talked about, even with yesterday's lecture, we applied Occam's razor to that, because there was a lot more that could go in. I didn't talk about, okay, with those savings examples we had, well, what about inflation? How does inflation factor into that? It's very real. We'll touch on inflation in this lecture because we're going to talk about money a little bit. But what else, you know, I was asked on the way up to lunch, well, where can I get a guaranteed 6% return on my investments? Well, you can't, okay? So took an assumption and said, okay, a 6% return. I just had to pick a number, but when I was in college, the number that we used for investments and time value of money and things was kind of an average of what the stock market did over a longer period of time. That number back then was about 8%. With the way things have gone, you know, 6% may or may not be a good number, but it's a little lower. But we also ended up with talking about personal debt. And so if you are blessed enough, and if your parents are blessed enough, and are at a point in their life where they don't have personal debt, and you think you've arrived, then there's this little reality that you're not really debt-free, because this is the U.S. debt that's on the books per man, woman, and child in the United States. And since 1990, it started out around, we'll call that about $15,000 per man, woman, and child. And today, it's closer to about $90,000 per man, woman, and child. So there are 10 people in my family. So my portion of that debt is about $930,000. That's kind of depressing. The timing of all this, and I'm not going to get into the debt ceiling debate and all that kind of stuff, I just wanted to kind of put this out as maybe a little bit of a sobering thought on the way that a somewhat socialistic society, how they view spending other people's money. And not only are they spending other people's money today, they're spending the future's money, the future generations, and all of y'all and all of y'all's children are going to be paying this back, and you're going to be paying a lot of interest on this debt over the coming decades. And I will also say this: it doesn't matter if you're red or blue; it's all the same. And we'll talk about that maybe if we have time later on. So let's talk about money. What's money? Well. Money, it's an intermediary. Money is something that doesn't have value in itself. but it has value for the things that can be acquired with it. Okay? Early on, a lot of societies traded through the barter system. A barter system works, but it's very inefficient. But then with the coining of precious metals and with other things, money was kind of developed, and people used money as a unit of value and as a unit of measure. So here's a kind of a textbook definition. Money is a unit or medium of exchange as a measure of value of wealth, as a store of value or purchasing power, and as a link between the past, present, and future. So when you're trying to measure the value of something, again, we talked the other night, can't talk about how many utils something is worth, but we can talk about how many dollars something's worth. When we enter into a trade or into an exchange, I order a pizza, or many pizzas to feed my family, that pizza may be worth $20 per pizza, okay? So I give $20, and that's how I measure the value of that pizza to me, because I'm willing to exchange 20 of my dollars, in this case, you know, little pieces of paper, don't have any value in and of themselves, but they have value because the guy at the pizza shop is willing to give me his pizza in exchange for my little pieces of paper, okay? They're not valuable in and of themselves, but for what I can get with them. The U.S. dollar initially was based on silver. The United States was not on the gold standard. The United States started out on the silver standard. The U.S. dollar was based on a silver coin that was about 27 grams or 371 grains of silver. And, of course, the Spanish were early adventurers and explorers, and the Spanish coin was often what was circulated in the early U.S. in the early colonial times. And in order to get fractional pieces of their dollars that were around 27 grams, they would cut those coins into eighths. Anybody ever hear pieces of eight? Treasure Island, pieces of eight. That's where that term came from, cutting those coins into eight pieces, because a whole coin may be worth too much for a particular transaction. So that's where that came from. In 1792, the Coinage Act that the U.S. government passed established the dollar as the currency, the official currency of the United States. And they didn't really define a dollar other than it was what everybody was already accepting. It was that 27-gram silver coin. But they said, we're going to accept this, because there were lots of versions of this dollar floating around in the economy. They said, we're just going to make this the official coin, the official currency of the United States. I may have gotten a little bit ahead of myself. Money has taken many forms over the years. Gold, obviously, silver, we just touched on that. Paper, beads, cigarettes, particularly in the prison camps during World War II, cigarettes became currency. They would trade cigarettes for different goods and services because they were portable. You could stick them in your pocket, you could trade them up, multiple cigarettes, so they made a reasonable money. What are some characteristics that money should have? Well, it should be portable. We touched on that. A high value in relation to weight or volume. Should be recognizable. Should be able to look at something and say, yeah, that's money. It should have a degree of durability. Shouldn't wear out. You don't want to use ice cream or ice cubes, unless maybe you live up in Antarctica. Maybe that might work. But certainly wouldn't work around here in the summer. And you want it to be divisible, easily divided, so that you can get fractional pieces or of your denomination that you're looking for. And money is, as we said, it's a unit of measure. It's a store of value. You know, we talked about saving earlier, and you're putting those dollars away for value for the future. And it's kind of a store of, an accounting of, the value that you have, or the potential value, once you convert that into goods or services, that you will have later on. Don't have money problems if you don't have money. Actually, you've got a different set of problems if you don't have money. All right. So this is what a dollar looked like in 1792, okay? A dollar in 1792 adjusted for inflation. From 1792 to 1913, that's 121 years, the cumulative rate of inflation was 3.13%. 120 years, the dollar lost about 3% of its value. Anybody, why would I have picked 1913 to draw the line on that? Just sing it out. Nope, not the income tax. What's that? Federal Reserve. Yep, in 1913, the Federal Reserve System was established to help control the money supply in the United States, to manage the booms and busts of the economic cycle. The Federal Reserve was established in 1913, and we had this little bump, this little hiccup there in inflation. Then what happened in, I think it was 1944? Anybody know? Nope. Not the Great Depression. Nope. Good guesses. This is a little more esoteric, a little bit more nerdy. So this was the Bretton Woods Agreement, okay? This was after, right, I guess, maybe it was 1947. I may have my dates wrong. But the U.S. and 43 other nations entered into this Bretton Woods Agreement, and they said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to have a currency regime where we can trade with amongst ourselves, and basically dollars can be converted into gold, and people will hold gold reserves in their banking system, and it basically helped to establish the dollar as the unit of international trade. Bretton Woods Agreement. So we're moving along the line of history here. And then something happened in the early 70s. I know this is way before y'all were born. This was, believe it or not, this was actually, not the 70s, but this part of the 70s, was actually before even I was born. In 1971, something else happened. Yeah, the gold standard was eliminated. So up until that time, you could convert your dollar bills into gold. And all countries had to have gold reserves in their banks, in the central banking system, so that if somebody wanted to convert a dollar into gold or $35 into gold, they could do it. The problem was, in 1971, Richard Nixon was president. They were running into all kinds of things, and the economy was in shambles, and people were converting gold. Richard Nixon says, you know, we don't have enough reserves. In gold reserves, so we're just going to close the gold window, and we're just going to completely decouple from the gold standard. And you can see what happened to inflation as a result of that. Inflation went through the roof. So the interesting thing is, where's my notes? Yeah, so from 1913, from here, from the establishment of the Federal Reserve, to 2023, that's 110 years, the cumulative rate of inflation was 2,964%. And this was under the system that was designed to stabilize the economy and the money supply. Okay? And I think these are signs of the times. And this is from Isaiah 1, 21 to 23. How the faithful city has become a harlot. She who is full of justice, righteousness once lodged in her, but now murderers. Your silver has become dross, your drink diluted with water. Your rulers are rebels and companions of thieves. Everyone loves a bribe and chases after rewards. They do not defend the orphan, nor does the widow's plea come before them. Inflation is a system of wealth transfer. It takes from savers because those dollars that you've put aside for the future become less valuable. It rewards debtors because those dollars that you've borrowed at current prices, you get to repay back at lesser prices. So going back to that very first slide that I shared to you with the United States debt, there are values to inflation because you can kind of, to some degree, inflate away the debt of the U.S. government to some degree. It doesn't really work that way because there ain't no such thing as free lunch, right? So what is inflation actually? Inflation is the devaluation of a currency. It's not that the price of other things is going up. It's that the value of the dollar that's in your pocket is going down. And it's a pernicious and it's a nefarious and it's an evil thing when it's manipulated and done by the government. Now, there were periods of inflation prior to the establishment of the Federal Reserve. When gold was discovered in California in 1849, a few years later, there was all of a sudden more gold that came into circulation. And there's a degree of inflation relative to that. But you know what's one of the things that sets that inflationary period aside from what we've gotten from the Federal Reserve? It took a lot of work to get gold out of the ground. You couldn't just snap your fingers and suddenly have a whole pile of gold. You had a lot of work and a lot of labor, and so it remained a relatively scarce resource. How many accountants or aspiring accountants do we have out there? Okay, we've got a few. All right. So for all y'all nerd bean counters, I'm one of them. The Federal Reserve is the only institution that I'm aware of that gets to do one-sided journal entries. So I'm speaking to a very small crew that understands that. But they're the only group that gets to do one-sided journal entries when they're creating money. I won't go there. There's a broader audience here. If you want to ask me about the one-sided journal entries, we'll talk later. But God abhors artificial inflation like this. You don't mix dross with your silver. You don't mix water with your wine. You don't mix them together to try to cheat somebody out of what they're paying for. When Mr. Hodges was lecturing, I wish I had a picture of this. When I was studying at the University of South Carolina, I had the opportunity to spend a little bit of time in Europe. And while I was there, one of my professors, who was also our tour guide, took us to St. Stephen's Cathedral in Vienna, Austria. And there on the side, on the wall, exterior wall of St. Stephen's Cathedral, there was this metal curve, I guess. It just looked like almost a crescent. There was one about this long, as I recall, and there was another one that was about this long. And they were both right there. And she was telling us, she said, you know what this is? What this is for? None of us students had any idea. She said, this was to measure the length of the loaf of bread that you bought from the baker across the square. If the baker was selling you bread, you could take that loaf of bread, hold it up to that little crescent, and determine, was he cheating me? Was the loaf of bread long enough? Or was I getting the full amount that I paid for? And I think that was interesting. That stuck with me because they were going to the church. They were going to God for justice in this instance. They were making sure the baker wasn't inflating or stealing from them by devaluing the currency or devaluing the bread, trying to cheat them out of the money there. So that was fascinating to me. But inflation is looked upon less than kindly by our God. All right, some more nerdy stuff here. This is from Fred. This is the Federal Reserve of St. Louis has Fred. Fred is great. You can get all kinds of nerdy data there. You can get all kinds of graphs and all kinds of economic information. But this is their balance sheet. And we're going to talk just for a little bit, and I don't want to get too technical, but this is the Federal Reserve's balance sheet from 2003 to 2009. And basically, the assets on their balance sheet were pretty stable. Pretty stable. Until out here. And then I referenced this yesterday, that was the Great Recession. And I'll hit this next slide. Oop, no, too early. That was the Great Recession. All of a sudden, there was this collapse, almost collapse of the financial system. There had been all kinds of squirrely stuff that people were doing that should never have been done. And to counter that, the Federal Reserve, doing some one-sided journal entries, decided they were going to go out and buy a bunch of assets, basically put a whole bunch of money into the economic system. They inflated. They went from the money supply, in essence, went from here up to here, virtually overnight. Okay? This is not M1, M2, the money supply, technical money supply figures, but this is a reasonable approximation for that. And this is the Federal Reserve balance sheet from 2003 to 2022. So here what I thought was disastrous at the time, because I was watching this graph. These guys look like incompetence as far as inflation goes. And I also put this in blue and red to represent who was in the White House, which party was in the White House, and it doesn't matter. Both of them, I put the colors up there just to show you that neither party has a monopoly on terrible economic theories and remedies, okay? They're both terrible, just my opinion. Milton Friedman, somebody asked me if I was going to quote Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman said that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon in the sense that it is and can be produced only by a more rapid increase in the quantity of money than in output. Okay? There's a graph that I did not put in here, but basically what Mr. Friedman or Dr. Friedman is saying here is if the money supply is growing faster than we can produce goods and services, that's where we get you've got more dollars chasing fewer goods and services, so the value of your dollar has to come down. And that's what we've seen. Kind of depressing, in my opinion. But I also want to share with you something else. And this goes back to some of what Dr. LeGates was talking about with progress in technology. Any idea? So this is me as a kid, right? I mean, I didn't have all that stuff, but this is amazing. This is absolutely amazing. How much would that smartphone in your pocket cost in 1985? Let's see if I can open this up. So that's not showing. What do I need to do to get that? this infographic pulled up here. Here come the reinforcements. Here comes the cavalry. All right. We'll answer this question in a moment. Sorry to connect to the Wi-Fi. Yeah, I think it is. Where did my cursor go? It was there just a moment ago. The other day too, disappeared on me. Let me just do. Oh, now I've done it. There we go. All right. Sorry about that. That's my family. And I talk about them and I show them. For two reasons. First, I love them. And for tax purposes, thank you. I really do have 8 kids. That's it, yeah. But it's not up there. Oh. All right. You are the man. Yeah, that's it. And then, if you don't mind, hang around, because I might need your help getting back to PowerPoint.
Can I scroll through this for you while you talk?
Yeah, that's great. We'll do this. Tag team this. Okay. Got Skype, you've got Zoom, you've got all this stuff. Processing power for a Cray supercomputer, $32 million. It's included, okay? So the cost of your smartphone in 2015, is a few years ago, the tech in your smartphone, $32,137,280. Okay? This goes back to what Dr. LaGates was saying about how technology lifts people out of poverty and is good for the environment. All that stuff. Imagine the resources that had to go into producing all those things that now fit in your pocket for a few hundred bucks. Okay? Two things that I'd like to say about that, if you don't mind to flip back to the PowerPoint. Well, actually, there's a lot that could be said about that. Well done. Thank you very much. A few things that could be said about that. One is, one of the things that's interesting is the technology industry, to a large degree, not entirely, but to a large degree, has not been as heavily regulated as most other industries. You've seen a lot of innovation in that space that has driven down prices. The other thing is that, what was the other thing? I don't know. We'll leave it at that. There may be some other things that pop into my mind, but we'll go from there. Let's go to Frederick Bastiat. We'll touch on him just a little bit. This is something I probably should have touched on earlier, but one of the things that he brought up and he developed was the broken window fallacy. And so this has also been coined or termed what is seen and what is not seen. And that's one of the things we need to think about when we think about economics. There are things that are seen and there are things that are not seen. And I'm looking at the time and I'm going to have to pick up the pace a little bit. Bastiat came up with the broken window fallacy. In this case, if you can't make that out, hit the right button. Sorry about that. Don't look, don't read. So this guy's reading a little note. It says, bricks thrown through the window, call Al's glass. All right? He's got a broken window. What do we know? What do we see? Before I get into this, Henry Hazlitt in 1940s, he was a reporter. He wrote a good little book. It's called Economics in One Lesson. Read it. A couple of my kids are smirking at me because I made them read it. It's a good book. It's an easy read. It's not written from a Christian perspective, but he does a good job developing this idea of what is seen and what is not seen. It's called Economics in One Lesson. So what's seen in this particular instant with the brick that was thrown through the window? The baker is upset because now he's got to pay $50 to repair the window. Someone else in the crowd that's walking by says, hey, look on the bright side. At least Al's glass is now going to be able to make $50 to replace your window. Al now has $50 to spend on other merchants. They, in turn, will have more to spend in the economy to keep the economy running. So those are all things that are seen, right? What's not seen? The baker had planned to buy a new pair of shoes, and now the cobbler is out $50 that he would have made otherwise. The baker, had Al not chucked the brick through his window, would have had both the shoes and his window, and more wealth would have been created because there would have been could have sold more bread, could have bought the shoes, and you got that money flowing through the economy to create. So there have been times when I've heard when there have been hurricanes, when there have been natural disasters, or even war. Hey, this is great because think of all the economic activity that's going to happen to rebuild after the war or to clean up after the hurricane. Yeah, there is economic activity, but what is not seen is all the other opportunities that were given up or that were lost as a result of those things. All right. What is seen? What is not seen? Protectionism and tariffs. I'm getting a little bit of this is somewhat political. It's not political. It's just economics. Protectionism and tariffs. Unfortunately, tariffs are one of the very few forms of taxation that are permitted by our U.S. Constitution. And they were codified in the Constitution. There's a problem with tariffs, though. There are many problems with tariffs. But one of the problems with tariffs is that, I'm falling asleep up here on the job. Hold on, let me get back to that thought. Okay, yes, there we go. Thought in the 1700s and earlier was the general economic theory was mercantilism. That is, that wealth was stagnant, that there was a certain amount of money, a certain amount of wealth in the world, and that in order for me to have more wealth, you had to have less, and vice versa. That wealth, that prosperity was a fixed amount. Bastiat wrote this story called The Candlemaker's Petition to talk about protectionism and tariffs. What did one candle say to the other? Birthdays just burned me up. Sorry. Dad joke. I'm a dad. So for real this time, The Candlemaker's Petition. This is what Bastiat relayed. The candlemakers bring a petition to the King of France, or to the, not the king, because he'd lost his head by this time, complaining about unfair competition from a foreign rival. Now, I'm just going to run through this fairly quickly, but it's a fairly short narrative that is relayed to us. They say, we, the candlemakers, are suffering from the unfair competition of a foreign rival. This foreign manufacturer of light has such an advantage over us that he floods our domestic markets with his product, and he offers it at a fantastically low price. The moment this foreigner appears in our country, all our customers desert us and turn to him. As a result, an entire domestic industry is rendered completely stagnant. And even more, since the lighting industry has countless ramifications with other native industries, they too are injured. Here's the petition. I'll come back to the petition. Since we have always served our country well, we the candle makers, gratitude demands that our country ought not to abandon us to this unequal competition. We hope that you gentlemen will not regard our petition as mere satire or refuse it without at least hearing the reasoning for it. If more tallow is consumed, naturally there must be more cattle and sheep. As a result, there will also be more meat, wool, and hides. There will even be more manure, which is the basis of agriculture and politics. Next, if more olive oil is consumed for lighting, we'll have extensive olive groves and rape fields. Also, our wastelands will be covered with pines and other resinous trees and plants. As a result of this, there will be numerous swarms of bees to increase the production of honey. In fact, all branches of agriculture will show an increased development. The same applies to the shipping industry. More ships, more whaling. Goes on and on and on and on. All the benefits, if the government would provide protection to the candle makers. I got a little bit ahead of myself here. Who was this foreign competitor that was really putting the hurt on the candle makers? You know what the petition was? Require everybody to close the shutters on their windows. Okay, now this is satire. This was Bastiat writing satire. But the point should be well taken here. His argument, or the argument of the candle makers in this satirical piece, was, hey, look at all the economic activity if you'll shut out free stuff coming into our society. Because think of all the benefits, all the economic benefits that will come. What's happening in that scenario? You're in essence, listening to Dr. LeGates yesterday talking about, potentially finding ways to shield the earth from the sun so that the earth doesn't cool and things like that made me think a little bit more about the candlemaker's petition. But what's happening if this candlemaker's petition were to come about? Everybody in France would be forced to buy candles. They'd basically be forced to enter into a coerced economic activity for the benefit of other people. It's a tax on the individuals. A couple of quotes. Walter Block: "Protectionism is a misnomer. The only people protected by tariffs, quotas, and trade restrictions are those engaged in uneconomic and wasteful activity. Free trade is the only philosophy compatible with international peace and prosperity." Walter E. Williams: "Tariff policy beneficiaries are always visible, but its victims are mostly invisible. Politicians love this. The reason is simple. The beneficiaries know for whom to cast their ballots, and the victims don't know whom to blame for the calamity." Most importantly, it's a violation of the Eighth Commandment. We have private property. We should be permitted to enter into any lawful, as defined by God, any lawful transaction we like. Unfortunately, these simple economic lessons are hard to learn. Obama got tough on China, put in a bunch of trade restrictions. And in the Washington Post, from which this headline came, not exactly a staunch bastion of Christian and conservative thought, but they published the headline, "Obama got tough on China and it cost U.S. jobs." Unfortunately, Trump getting tough on China. Billions of dollars are pouring into the coffers of the USA because of the tariffs being charged to China. And there's a long way to go. If companies don't want to pay tariffs, build in the USA. Otherwise, let's just make our country richer than ever before. Stealing from all of you to put money in the coffers of the US government. Really? All right, what is seen? Billions of dollars flowing into U.S. coffers. The possibility of added jobs in sectors preferred by the government. We want these. We like these areas. We like these types of businesses. We like these industries. Typically, they're the most politically connected industries. It reduced output by an economic competitor. Remember, this goes back to that mercantilistic philosophy that we can only become wealthier by somebody else becoming poorer. That is not true. What's not seen? Higher prices paid by every U.S. citizen in the process. It's a subsidy of inefficient production. And there's less wealth in the competitor economy with which to buy U.S. goods and services. And as Dr. LeGates has been pointing out again and again, being able to raise what was a third world economy is becoming first world in China. We should have compassion for the poor. And a lot of these economic policies don't have true compassion for the poor. And we should view those who are working, who are laboring, even in countries that are hostile to the gospel, as those countries open up to trade, those are channels by which the gospel has entry into those countries that would not otherwise exist. Okay, not trying to be political up here on this, I'm trying to make you think about things from a different perspective, from a biblical perspective. We touched on that. Let me talk about something else just for a few minutes. In Hurricane Katrina in 2005, my wife and I had the privilege of being in Louisiana, Baton Rouge, stayed with some friends down there for a few days. just actually a few couple months before Hurricane Katrina came through and devastated southern Louisiana. These were gas lines. Now, what I thought was a little bit funny, the price of regular at $3.59, and everybody was going nuts because the price of gasoline had gone through the roof. You know, it's not that bad. I mean, it's still bad today, but it's, you know, we don't form gas lines if we see $3.59 at the gas pump anymore. All right. What happened after Katrina? It happened up in Kingsport, where I was living at the time. It happened particularly in the states impacted by Katrina. Governor stepped in and issued price controls. We talked about those a little bit the other day, but here's some real-life examples. John Shepperson, after Hurricane Katrina, we talked about the price controls being stepped in. John Shepperson bought 19 generators, rented a U-Haul truck, and drove 600 miles from Kentucky to Mississippi. His intention was to sell the generators for double the price he paid for them, gouging the residents of Mississippi. John was arrested for price gouging. He spent 4 days in jail. The generators were confiscated, and the people of Mississippi were spared from paying too much for those generators. Justice was served. Or was it? John put his time, money, and to a degree, life at risk, drove 1,200 miles round trip to deliver generators to the people of Mississippi. Thanks to the intervention, thanks to the government intervention, the people of Mississippi now had access to fewer generators than they would otherwise have had. Okay? Now, We must be careful just outright condemning John Shepperson for taking advantage of an opportunity. But I will also say this. He put a lot at stake, a lot at risk to do that. Obviously, it didn't work out well for him. We know that the righteous is generous and gives, okay? But there's also, look at the way, and this all worked out in God's providence, but look at how God's invisible hand of providence was working through the profit motive to deliver an additional 19 generators to the people of Mississippi. Okay? Without that, this attempt would never have been made. And it does make me think about Bastiat's quote, "When law and morality contradict each other, the citizen has the cruel alternative of either losing his moral sense or losing his respect for the law." I'm going to go through a couple of these other slides pretty quickly. This is just graphing what happens with those price caps. Here's what the supply is at the price cap. Here's what the demand is. So you have a shortage of generators, gas, whatever it happens to be. One of the interesting things that came out of Hurricane Katrina, and this I remember hearing this at the time, NPR, again a bastion of political conservatism and Christian thought. I'm a little bit of an NPR nerd. I get most of my news from there. I understand the perspective that they're coming from. It's horrible, but they do a pretty good job of covering a lot of stuff. But they interviewed Mayor Phil Capitano of Kenner, Louisiana. This was after the hurricane. And this is what he had to say. Let me back up just a minute. After Katrina flooded the city of Kenner, Louisiana, the first relief did not come from state officials or from federal officials. It came from at the time, the nation's biggest company, actually I think still is as far as employees. Several days after the storm passed, Walmart sent in trucks loaded with water, ice, and canned goods to help thousands of stranded residents. Mayor Phil Capitano says the company set an example for the federal government. This was NPR. This is what the mayor said. FEMA couldn't get here. The Red Cross couldn't get here. Homeland Security couldn't get here. The only one who could get here was the Walmart Corporation. We were we are extremely appreciative and extremely grateful for them. And we'd certainly suggest that maybe some of those other folks go over and meet with the Walmart people so they can learn distribution and logistics. What does Walmart have going for it that they know how to run distribution and logistics? What did that company, what did Sam Walton establish that company to do? Profit. Make a profit. It works, right? It works. And what's also interesting, this was Walmart's charitable side. They were doing this not for a profit motive in this particular instance. They were exhibiting that righteous is generous and gives. They saw a need. Now, did they do it just purely out of the kindness of their heart? Probably not. They said, you know, we can get some good PR out of this, right? That's okay. But they were able, through that, to serve the people of Louisiana. And, you know, Walmart is often hated, it's reviled, but Walmart has done wonders to bring the standard of living of Americans way up, because they produce and they sell goods and services that people want and need at a low price, okay? You can argue with some of the tactics and whatnot, but at the end of the day, the reason Walmart is successful is because they serve. They serve, okay? How are we doing on time here? All right. I am going to, in the interest of time, let's see if I can do this without, because I know that, let's see, that's not what I want. All right, let me find, let's see, just a couple other things. Do this, I do need to share this. Thomas Sowell, great economist. The first lesson of economics is scarcity. There's never enough of anything to satisfy all those who want it. The first lesson of politics is to disregard the first lesson of economics. That is so true. All right. And I did hear one, yes, okay, I appreciate that. All right. And that's true. I mean, you know, look at the political campaigns that were run here a few years ago. Free education, we're going to forgive your college student loan debt, provide for free child care, we're going to build a wall in Mexico, and Mexico's going to pay for it. Take your pick. We're going to promise the world, vote for me, right? Promise the world, vote for me. All right. I'm going to get through a bunch of this, and sorry. I did want to share this. My original artwork on Quaker Barrel, okay? My original. So I have a graphic design and marketing person here that I will not point out. And I'm sure she is appalled at what I have done with the graphics here, okay? That's not my skill set. But what I was going to go through with this very quickly. We have Donald and Daffy, okay? And they are applying at the Quaker Barrel, obviously. There are good reasons for that. And so one is a little more skilled in their labor. This is an example of minimum wage, a price floor. Donald can produce 12 meals a day, 12 meals an hour. They sell the meals. I should have updated numbers, but I didn't. $4 a meal. He can generate $48 of revenue for Quaker Barrel in an hour. And then they pay the minimum wage. I know it's $7 and change today, but let's just, for argument's sake, $10. The overhead, at the end of the day, Donald's making $13 in profit for Quaker Barrel. He gets hired. He gets the job. Daffy Duck, he can produce 8 meals in an hour. $4 a meal, so he generates $32 of revenue, okay? You still have the same minimum wage. You still have the same amount of overhead. Problem is, Donald costs the business $3 for every hour that he's working. Donald is not going to get the job. Okay? This is a tragedy of the effect of minimum wage. Minimum wage prices out those who are at the lowest end of the skill set sector. These are the folks that need to learn job skills. These are the folks that need to learn to be able to work and to serve, to help others to lift themselves up out of poverty. If you put a minimum wage on it, you're going to price those folks out. They're not going to be able to get the skills that they need to succeed and to work later on. Very simple. Occam's razor here. Very simple example. That's what I wanted to share with you. Frank Winfield Woolworth. Quick example. I heard this. I was listening to a book by Thomas Sowell. I don't remember which one it was, but he brought this example early on in the book. He started his career working for free, sweeping the floors in a dry goods store. Sweeping the floors. He wanted to get paid, but the owner of the store said, "You don't have the skill set. I'm not paying you anything." Frank said, "I don't care. I need the skill set. Please let me work for you, and I'll work for free." Deal. Okay? He developed a novel idea, and it revolutionized how stores operate. So at the time, if you were buying something at the dry goods store, you'd go up to the counter, you'd write down what you want, the clerk would take your order, and he'd go back behind the counter, pull off the shelves your stuff, and put it on the counter to you, and then you'd take it home. Woolworth said, "You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take all the stuff, and I'm going to put it out in front. I'm going to put it in the windows so people can walk by and see it, and then I'm going to put it out on shelves and people can pick up their stuff, and then they'll come to the counter and pay, and we'll do that." He got that idea while he was sweeping floors. He eventually became one of the wealthiest men in the world. And he was using his gifts and abilities and ideas to serve others. This is the Woolworth Tower. At the time he built this, in 1930, the Woolworth Building was the tallest building in the world. And it's still within the top, I forget what the number is, but it still ranks up there. Let me just read this. 1 Peter 4:10. "As each one has received a special gift, employ it in serving one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God." Okay? As Dr. LaGates has said many times, glorify God, treat others as equals, serve them. Treat them as you would be treated. Just a few resources here, and these will be available. I will say the Mises Institute is a fantastic resource for economics. I will also say this. It is not, there are a lot of Christians that write for Mises Institute, but there are many, many, many that do not. Be careful what you take away from the Mises Institute. But as a resource, it is very valuable. A couple of books. The Foundation for Economic Education is good. A couple books. Economics for Real People. I would highly recommend this. Very, 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 very readable. You can download a PDF of this for free from the Mises Institute. He writes in very relatable terms, and he covers a lot of stuff. I love this book. Prosperity and Poverty, another of my favorites. Cal Beisner was already referenced by Dr. LaGates. All of my kids, for their econ, have to read this. Phenomenal. Great book. I've referenced The Tragedy of American Compassion by Marvin Alasky. Again, a very readable book. I would recommend that strongly. The Road to Serfdom is a classic. Economics in One Lesson. Whatever Happened to Penny Candy? Very quick, very easy read on the monetary system, money. It's great. I've referenced this, used this quite extensively, Economics, Principles, and Policy from a Christian Perspective by Tom Rose. You can find it probably on eBay. Human Action by Mises, and an economic commentary on the Bible, Genesis to Revelation by Gary North. I have not read it cover to cover. I've used excerpts and pieces and references from it, but it is a very good resource. Other authors, these guys are not believers, but there's common grace, and there's a lot of good information from these guys as well. Lots of other resources that I could point you to. Before I finish up, I will say this. If you all want to ask me questions or want more resources, my email address, for real, is not mikemyers@gmail.com. It is robert.37617@gmail.com. robert.37617@gmail.com. And that's all I have to say about that.